Yeah, I want him. Okay, you got him, Prado answered. That phone conversation had been only last week. I now looked at John, gazing at the map. I glanced at Jack, the quiet academic who was drafted from a counter-narcotics assignment to help us. He understood networks and the analytical process, a smart, shy, gentle man who worked tirelessly. I looked at Frank, thick and beefy, sweating profusely as his mind worked in overdrive. He knew as much about covert action and strategy as anybody in the agency. He was a contradiction. Rough-hewn and blunt in manner, he possessed an intellect that was sharply nimble, elegantly nuanced, and honed with intense academic rigor. He happily boasted about his delinquent childhood, but refused to discuss heroic professional deeds. As a young man, he saved himself by enlisting in the Marine Corps. As a CIA officer in Africa, he saved a city by negotiating the surrender of a corrupt army to an invading rebel force. Frank earned quiet clandestine service recognition for his heroic deeds. Frank built on this experience and the far more complex, more structured covert action programs that he ran during the 1990s. He explored the covert action nexus of intelligence and policy. He experimented and he studied the results. While a student at the War College, he drafted a treatise on the history of U.S. covert action and won an academic prize. He earned a reputation as a sharp strategist. Frank and I had compared notes about intelligence, covert action, and war whenever our paths had crossed, but we had never worked together until now. He was now my strategic advisor, covert action guru, and director of all our information operations in post-9/11 Afghanistan. "What are our strategic objectives?" I asked Frank. "There are three," he responded. "First, we must destroy AQ leadership. Second, we must deny them safe haven. Third, we must attack the political, social, economic conditions the enemy exploits." Typical. He boiled down complex issues and plans into a few simple declarative sentences. "Where are our allies?" I asked, gesturing to the map. I had a good idea, since I had been working this problem for the last 3 years, but I needed precise coordinates. I needed to know where to drop our teams, where to start, and then where to go. I needed to know our Afghan allies' plans, which would certainly be fractured and incomplete, given their lack of resources and their inability, and more often, unwillingness, to communicate and cooperate with each other. "Here," Frank said, pointing to the Panjshir Valley. "And here, south of Mazar-e-Sharif. Maybe here, east of Herat. The Hazara Shia in Bamiyan province, west of Kabul, may hold a patch of turf. They really hate the Taliban." "The south sucks, doesn't it?" I pointed to Kandahar and the surrounding area, the Taliban heartland. "Yep. But Greg is talking to Karzai, who is from here," John noted as he pointed to a town north of Kandahar, Tarin Kot. I knew that Greg would be in the fight. I wondered about his relationship with Karzai, a Pashtun tribal leader whose father had been murdered by the Taliban. Karzai would be critical to the strategy in the south. I did not know that Greg and Karzai were already plotting the details of their deployment. "Maybe our allies will have enough control in the north, but we need the south. We cannot allow AQ a safe haven in the south or anywhere, and we must avoid an Afghan civil war, with Pashtun Taliban against the rest, a north-south conflict." I estimated that our allies held less than 10% of the country. Perhaps they had influence and access to another 10%. Maybe they had sporadic reach into yet another 10%. The Taliban and their tribal allies had everything else. I focused on our Afghan allies. I knew they would be the key to victory. Only they understood the terrain. Only they could recruit other Afghans to join us. Only they could penetrate the Taliban at all levels, and only they could move immediately. The U.S. military knew little about Afghanistan because there was no conventional threat, and our military was overwhelmingly conventional. They would take many months to mobilize any sizable force. The CIA paramilitary corps numbered only a few dozen, and not all of them were right for this mission. We had to move fast, given the threat of another attack in the homeland, and our ability to move fast depended upon the success of our Afghan alliance. Schroen and his jawbreaker team are in the Panjshir already. What do they need? I asked. Yes, they just arrived. They are okay now, but will soon require more money, more ammo, more men, more everything. Here in HQS, we must build an admin support staff, a reporting analytical staff, a targeting section, and several ops teams to deploy, John said. Then do it. John, you and I approve every team leader and every team deputy for the field and for HQS. They have to complement each other. They must be able to make decisions, the right decisions, rapidly. This is about leaders. This is about speed and precision. This must be a flat, dynamic network. I knew that if we did not select the right officers, the teams would fail, perhaps not even survive. That was the first night. The next morning, after a couple hours of sleep, I was in Kofor's office. He loomed large in size and manner, speaking forcefully and waving his huge hands in the air to make a point. A couple of times he slapped the table. He recounted how he and Rich had briefed National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice in July about the imminent AQ threat, with no response from her or others in the White House. He noted the 8 August 2001 President Daily Brief, PDB article titled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S. that CTC had drafted and delivered to the White House. It was a remarkable example of strategic warning, explicitly referring to the 1993 World Trade Center attack as an example that UBL wanted AQ bringing the fight to America. The warning even noted UBL's intent to strike Washington. I later studied the document and wondered what President Franklin Roosevelt would have done had he received such an assessment about Japanese plans to attack Pearl Harbor a full month before December 7, 1941. Kofor then described how he and Tenet had briefed the President and National Security Council only days earlier, just after 9/11. This was when Kofor made his famous flies on the eyeballs pitch to President Bush for the CIA to lead the response. He had thrown a stack of papers on the floor in a dramatic display. He had encouraged, even respectfully challenged, the President and his entire national security team to take the enemy head-on. Kofor assured them that the CIA knew how to launch this attack. Kofor and Tenet both wanted the authority and the resources to wage war. President Bush gave it to them. As Kofor explained to me, nobody else had even thought about Afghanistan. Nobody else at the table had any fucking idea. There was nobody else. Certainly I could understand that, but that did not explain the courage required for Kofor, with Director Tenet in support, to step forward and assume such responsibility. Clausewitz, in his classic On War, stressed the courage of responsibility over all other forms of courage. Without that type of bravery, there can be no leadership and no victory. Standing before me was perhaps the best example I had ever witnessed. I was honored to be working for him again. Really, our national security response was extraordinary. The White House turned to a CIA operations officer for guidance, for leadership, in the worst homeland crisis since Pearl Harbor. It reflected how war was evolving, how asymmetric conflict by non-state actors across a global battlefield was upending the U.S. concept of war. There was no national army for the Pentagon to fight. There was no accessible criminal enterprise that the FBI could arrest. There was no foreign ministry or equivalent for the State Department to engage. There was no international body with the authority, power, or understanding to take on this challenge. There were just a handful of CIA officers who had been gnawing on this problem for years. With no others volunteering for the job, Kofor stepped forward to assume the lead role. "Kofor, do they really understand what we face?" I asked. "I'm not sure. The president probably does. He's smarter than most think, and he wants us to attack now. Rumsfeld, he's an asshole who cares about his own power more than anything else. But as long as the president sticks with us, we're okay. Right now, he has nobody else." "Thanks for calling me back. I was waiting," I admitted. Kofor gave me his hard stare as he compressed his lips. "For the last 2 years, I've heard you bitch about the enemy safe haven in Afghanistan. Well, now you have the mission. The glove